I'm terribly sorry that I don't know people's names, which really I should have tried to do something about that for the first time. But is one of you Victoria? Yes, right. Okay. You mentioned this, and I emailed you.
Yes, thank you. But
I've also prepared a little bit more. Now, just in case anyone wants to write an essay relating to this course, here's a list of possible essay titles. So there's a little bit of a reading list, and that will help you write an essay. Okay, and you can communicate with me for more information, you know, and help in terms of if you do decide you want to write one of these essays, you know. I could maybe give a bit more bibliographical material and more suggestions about how to go about the essay. Now, last week, we were looking at the second topic, life and teachings in 16th century Tzfat. And we didn't finish that topic. And I said that because those concepts are quite central, we would try and continue with last week's topic today. So I hope you've got the material from last week. Right now, this is really jumping into the deep end in a way, and it's quite a challenge to try to understand these concepts. So let me try to present them. See, we've got here, we're beginning at number 5, Tzimtzum, contraction, veiling of the divine to enable creation to take place. And then there's something even more mysterious in number 6, the breaking of the vessels. Further levels of concealment of the divine. Number 7, spiritual sparks in physical existence. And number 8, the process of tikkun, repair. Okay, now all these run one into the other. And let's see whether within the next few minutes we can get any further in understanding them. Can I ask how many of you have heard the concept Tzimtzum? Okay, that's quite true. And breaking of the vessels, Shvirat HaKelim. And I suppose Tikkun is quite a popular concept. There's even used to be a magazine called Tikkun. You know, that's like an in word. All right, well, we're going to try and understand it. We first of all have the problem that the human mind and what we call understanding, first of all, it's very good at understanding, you know, how to cut down trees and build a log hut or a raft, and how to give fodder to the animals. And it might get more sophisticated, you know, how to make a computer or a spaceship. But it's still the human mind working with fairly tangible. But once you get into science, it's interesting that the concepts do become more elusive. But it's dealing with structures that we can somehow get our mind around, and even when it's mathematical structures, so we define our language, our algebraic or whatever it might be, language, and we use that language. So here we're trying to grapple with the language of the Kabbalists. And if I can present it in a slightly more philosophical way, maybe that will make things a little bit more comfortable for me, thinking that I'm actually communicating something instead of just words or, you know, making a sort of statements which can't be understood. So, if we think of Hashem as the infinite, absolutely beyond everything, beyond all qualities. And in fact, that term, Ein Sof, the term which the Kabbalists like using for God, Ein Sof, without end, infinite, absolutely, absolutely beyond any kind of, not beyond in the sense of being far away, because the infinite is right here as well, but beyond any kind of definition or description or any kind of terminology. It's just infinite, Ein Sof, beyond everything. In fact, the word Kadosh, 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 Kadosh in Hebrew, one of the ways of understanding that is beyond. Kadosh means set apart. And set apart, so when you say something is holy, it means it's set apart from ordinary use. But God is holy in the sense of being beyond any kind of ordinary definitions or any kind of rational processes. Now then you have our world over here, okay, which is basically a tangible world. And tangible in the sense that we can see it and touch it and feel it and we're part of it. And it's what we call finite. So finite means something which has got a limited, it's limited. Yes, this table could be measured. I don't know, maybe it's 2 foot long and maybe 3 foot, 2 foot by 3 foot. So it's got a specific measurement. So here we have a tangible and finite world. Right, so I'll put the word world. Now, you could just say that infinite God created the finite world, full stop. That's the mystery of creation. At the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth, Bereshit bara Elokim, et ha-shamayim ve-et ha-aretz. But the Kabbalists are not satisfied with just putting things so simply, because, and this is my suggestion, yes, it's not, it's really a suggestion, because of the intimation, the feeling, that within the tangible finite world, there is spirituality, there is holiness, somehow or other, hidden there. As I quoted previously, Ha'olam, we're going to write it defectively, not with Ha'olam, right? The world and the word He'elem. Concealment have the same, so this is world and that's concealment. And they've got the same consonants, different vowels. So the world is a concealment of the divine. So somehow, as well as there being this tangible, finite world, it's also somehow got the divine in it as well. So what we want are the steps. How do we get from the infinite to the divine? Right? Now, when we look at Zoharic Kabbalism, the basic system of the Sefirot, which we looked at last week, remember we had a diagram of the Sefirot, and you can speak about different worlds, different levels, that there is a higher level, the world of Atzilut, and then the next level down, which is, let's put a line there somehow, there's the world of Briah, creation, and then another step down, the world of formation, and then finally the world of action, and you can imagine a kind of a spiritual stepping down process where there is a flow of godliness coming down and infusing and giving existence and life to the world but through a process of a kind of stepping down the energy. Now, stepping down the energy is a phrase which is associated with electricity and transformers, yes? Lovely toys, which, you put 240 volts into the transformer and you can get 12 volts at the end. That's what we do whenever we plug in something to our computer. We normally have a little transformer in the middle because the computer doesn't run on 240 volts, it runs on much less, 12 or 24 sometimes. And so that's the stepping down process. It's interesting that these Kabbalistic texts have this idea of stepping down, even though they didn't have the idea of electricity and transformer. So we could see in that way a kind of a gradual tapering off of godliness reaching into the world so that the world has got this divine dimension to it, but it's sort of this gradual, the diagram doesn't really express the way it's gradually getting less, but if you imagine the up-down, up means higher voltage and down means reduced voltage. So, which in fact is why we say up and down. Really, up and down has no relevance because it's all happening over here. But the up means a greater intensity of godliness. Now that's how it appears in Zohar texts with the idea of the sphera. However, the Zohar has lots of different parts to it, and there are some very, very mysterious passages. And in the 16th century in Tzfat, Rabbi Isaac Luria began teaching a concept which hadn't really been explored before. And he based it on passages in the Zohar, which he was now explaining for the first time in this way. And that is, you see, if you have, now I'm giving a kind of a commentary. If it's all just a gradual descent down, it doesn't seem to have the tension and the problems which are associated with our lives in the physical world. It doesn't seem such a gentle gradient. We seem to be more on, what a roller coaster is, up, down. We seem to have a more complex relationship with existence and with God, which has got all kinds of dangerous dimensions, sin and repentance, paradoxes. Why should a person sin? If they've got this beautiful gradient of godliness coming down into the tangible, finite world, well, obviously, everything is very spiritual, and that the Torah, which is also coming from God, there we have the Torah coming down, it tells us how to live. Why on earth should anyone ever break the Torah? Why should Adam and Eve eat from the tree of knowledge? Couldn't they just follow what God was telling them to do? If it's all such a nice, happy gradient, then you would have expected everyone to fit in the right way. So Rabbi Isaac Luria, he said, it's not such a straight, gentle gradient. The thing is, there are big jumps. And the big jumps, the biggest jump of all is right at the beginning, and that is what he calls tzimtzum. Tzimtzum, the veiling or contraction of godliness, which is establishing a kind of huge jump from the infinite. Tzimtzum, right? Literally, the word means contraction, and I'm going to try to explain that imagery, which is rather daring imagery in a minute. So in other words, this is a very, very heavy, he calls it a parsa, a veil, a curtain, a very heavy curtain hiding godliness. And in fact, at each of these different levels of world, where I did put a black line, there's another level of symptoms. See, that's also different levels of tzimtzum, different levels of contraction and concealment, in order that a really reduced level of radiance is able to come down into the world, and that's gone through several different steps of concealment. Now, the initial tzimtzum, the initial contraction, is described in very graphic, you might say anthropomorphic terms. It's not anthropomorphic, but it is applying some kind of morphos, some kind of form to this divine process. And let me explain to you the image. It is what is written in the Eitz Chaim, the Tree of Life, which is the name of the book that Rabbi Chaim Vital wrote, expounding the teachings of his teacher, Rabbi Isaac Luria. So we're going to keep on this board, but we're going to look at the other half of it. Now, first of all, we have to use our imagination and imagine that this is not just billions of miles, not just billions of light years, but it's infinite, beyond any measure whatsoever. And the infinity that we can see here with our mind's eye is the absolute infinity. Well, in fact, Ein Sof, let's say, is beyond even imagining. At this moment, we're looking at last week's text, which we've got. Good. That's absolute infinity beyond even imagining. Let's just call it Or Ein Sof, the radiance of the infinite. The radiance of the infinite. You see, beyond the radiance is the source of the radiance, which you can't even say it's radiant. It's beyond that. But it's the radiance of the infinite filling this entire spot. Be very careful. Careful how you look. It's such an intense radiance, nothing can exist in the face of this radiance. Lo yirani ha'adam b'chai. Man cannot see me and live. Nothing finite could exist at all. It would just be blown to smithereens. It's like putting 3 billion volts into one of these light fittings. It's smashed. The whole thing's gone straight away. So nothing can be there. Then comes the moment of tzimtzum. And that is a kind of withdrawal. You've got to see how to see this circle. The circle is a withdrawal or a veiling of the light to the edges. Right? A little bit like the iris. Yes, when it's a dark room, so the iris retreats to the edge, the iris of the eye. And you just have the big pupil in the middle. You have the big empty space in the middle. So there is a withdrawal of the radiance to the edges. And this is actually called empty space. It's sometimes chalal ha-panui. In fact, the word for space that the Kabbalists used became the modern Ivrit word for like chalalit, the spaceship. Chalal, space. But here it means really empty space. It means we're not talking here about matter here. Even godliness is veiled. Now there's an argument. You see, this word tzimtzum literally means contraction. And if we apply that word literally, it implies that God has contracted out of this space, so to speak. There's no God in that space. Now, other Kabbalists later on, in the next century, in the 6th, 17th century, refused to accept that idea. They said, you can't say God is not in that space. You can say God is veiled. So it's an argument. What did Rabbi Isaac Luria really mean? And so the general way in which it's taught is that this space has got godliness in it, but it's empty relative to the way it was before. Godliness is sufficiently veiled at this level for the process of creation to begin. Now, how does the process of creation begin? there's going to be a flow of radiance coming in to this sort of empty room. The blue represents the infinite, godly, divine radiance. So there's a flow of radiance which is going to come in, and it's going to, well, one way we can understand it, it's going to create sphirot. Now, sphirot are a kind of containing of the divine radiance. Let's imagine something like that. I mean, these are very, you know, these are physical images. And of course, we're talking about something which is beyond physical images. But it's a little bit like when you say in mathematics, E equals mc squared. So E is energy and mass is, m is mass and c is the speed of light. You're just using letters to represent completely things which are on a completely different level of being. Yes, c is the speed of light. So how can you say that, you know, c is just a little letter that you write on the blackboard? But that's what's happening here. We are using kind of diagrammatic images in order to express something which is really infinite. And we have to be aware that it's just a language to try to define a process which is taking place. Now, what is this vessel? You see, we then have the next step. See, that's one sphera, let's say, and then there's another sphera. And a sphera is, last week we talked about sphera more, a sphera is a kind of containing of the light in such a way that the light, okay, I'm going to do a few at a time from this, right? I'm cheating, okay? So it's a containing of the light in such a way that the light has, it begins to assume sort of finite qualities. It's able to operate in a more tangible, finite way, such as it might be the sphera kindness, chesed. So that's the kindness of God. Or it might be severity. Right? So these are attributes of godliness. And so from infinite God, who is beyond attributes, beyond any kind of description, this is a way of graphically describing God as assuming a certain, veiling himself so that attributes can be seen. But the way in which the attributes fall is described as a flow of radiance into a vessel. Now, well, it might sound very flippant, but when I was a little boy, one of my favorite comic books was about a figure called Rupert. And Rupert had this interesting faculty, somehow, for being able to have a kind of, it was a kind of a glass bowl of light. And this somehow, I'm not sure whether this was in one story or in many stories, but somehow this really stuck with me over the years. And so this idea of a glass bowl filled like a little goldfish bowl or a lantern, but there isn't a candle in the lantern, there's light in the lantern. It's and so this way of carrying around light and of somehow having a goldfish bowl filled with light, that's the kind, somehow, this kind of image to express a vessel and the radiance which is within the vessel. So we've got, so now the vessel, the aspect that I'm calling vessel, and which is called vessel, Kali, that's the Hebrew. How does that relate to the radiance which is inside it? And one of the ways it's described, it's hit avut ha'or, a thickening of the light. hit Agud with an ayin. A thickening of the light. So in other words, the light thickens, and that becomes the wall of the vessel, and in that way we're able to contain the radiance in a vessel. All this is part of the process of bringing this radiance down into the world. Now, really, that's what the concept of Sphira is. Yes, I mean, this is just a footnote explanation. What do we mean by these Sphirot that we discussed last week with this diagram? They are sort of vessels of radiance, and it's a thickening of the light which makes the vessel. However, what we're moving towards here is something else. We are moving towards a spiritual explanation for the tensions, ambiguities, and paradoxes of existence. And not only the paradoxes of existence, the paradoxes in the Torah itself. The Torah is full of paradoxes. And this teaching is moving towards producing a further idea. You see, Tzimtzum, the idea that there is a big veil, a jump from Ein Sof to the beginning of the down-chaining of the worlds, right? That's a real Kabbalistic term. Hishtalshalut ha'olamot, the down-chaining of the worlds. So the idea that there's a big jump to that, that's one step in us understanding the tension between existence and its divine purpose. But now we're going to see another step. In this process, and again, the mode of this teaching is one of interruption. It's not a straightforward thing. The Torah is full of interruptions. The Jews get the Torah, beautiful. Interruption, golden calf. They set off to go to the land of Israel, an 11-day journey, interruption, the spies. They finally get into the land of Israel 40 years later, they build the temple, everything's finished, good, it's King Solomon, this is it. Interruption. The generation after Solomon, the country divides in two, civil war, eventually the destruction of the temple. So it's these interruptions. It's these interruptions in Torah and in life and in the whole process of history, which is that what this theoretical interruption, you could say, is explaining. What's the interruption over here? It all seems fine and dandy. The radiance is flowing into the vessels, and there's a long chapter in the Lurianic writings going from it comes down into this sphera, and then it flows into the next sphera, and then into the next sphera. But a terrible problem suddenly emerges. The radiance is too intense for the vessels, and as a result, the vessels break, they smash, they explode because of the tremendous intensity, something we understand perfectly well. The poor electrician, somehow or other, getting the electricity into the place, instead of it being 240 volts, it was 700 volts. One light after the other, it just goes out. So that's what's happening over here. The light is so intense. And interestingly, there's a problem with the Sphirot themselves. This is the way it's explained, particularly in Hasidic teachings, which give it a more like ethical dimension as well. The Sphirot were each very singular. Kindness is kindness, severity is severity. They just were held themselves to themselves. There was no give. There was no elasticity. There was no multiplicity in the Sphirah. And as a result, I don't quite know how to portray it, but, you know, there we have one after another, the Sfirot, as it were, explode, they are shattered, they break, and the result of them breaking causes the emergence of what is called, if we extend our world over here, yeah, here we have the world, nice mountainous world, if you like mountains. So there, in the world, we suddenly get bits of Sfirot. Let's take this purplish color. So we have bits of Sfirot which are broken. And these broken bits of Sfirot, I mean, obviously, this is very, very, you know, it's taking this graphic image to another level, that the thickening of light, which is the kind of wall of the vessel of the Sfirah, becomes something or other in the world, and it's got a name. It's called Klipa. Klipa literally means shell. But it's something which is understood as concealing godliness and acting against godliness in certain ways. However, in each of these klipot, in each of these spiritual klipot, these spiritual shells, there is a spark of light. So here we have shells, klipot. And there's a kind of a spark of light which is part of this very intense light. Now this very intense light is called the radiance of Tohu. Does anyone know what the word Tohu means?
Chaos.
Yes, chaos. Tohu and Bohu. At the beginning of existence, it says in Bereshit, the world was Tohu and Bohu. Chaos, whatever English words are used to explain both those terms. So it's a radiance of chaos. So the radiance of chaos it's that intense radiance which is there inside this first stage of Sfirot, of divine emanations, and that makes the Sfirot shatter, so to speak. And as a result, in other words, there's an interruption in the whole process of creation. There's an interruption on an ethereal level. This is before the universe begins being made, before let there be light. It's in a stage before that. It's the steps leading up to creation. But at this point, there is an interruption, if you like, setting the pattern for lots of interruptions in the future. So that means, well now we have to come to the second stage. So the first stage is the breaking of the vessels. So breaking of the vessels is the first stage of creation. It's, I mean, it wasn't supposed to be, or if you like, God did intend it that way. The whole question of, did God want it that way? Did God want Adam and Eve to eat from the tree of knowledge? If so, why did he let the snake be there? Who is actually directing the whole thing? Were the Jews supposed to receive the Torah and that would be the end of the matter? No, they made the golden calf, you know. So where is God in that situation? And so on. So let's take it for the moment that it's all part of the divine will. There's the breaking of the vessels in stage one, or is the end of stage one. And then we have stage two, which is a new form of creation. Now, I think you know the word for the new form of creation. What's that? We mentioned it before.
Tikkun,
absolutely. Lovely. So there we have Tikkun. The second stage is Tikkun. Now, if we have Tikkun, so it's no longer radiance of chaos. So we can rub that out altogether, and we'll take off all these little dashes which indicate the way everything is smashing, is being smashed. However, what we have now is a multiplicity. Within kindness, There are lots of different qualities. There's kindness of kindness, there's severity of kindness. And within severity, there's severity of severity, and there's kindness of severity. So everything includes its opposite. In fact, each sphera, instead of being one sphera, it's made of seven sphera. There are seven lower sphera. We're talking about those seven lower sphera. So the seven lower sphera, each one is made up of the other seven as well. They all interconnect. Now, in engineering terms, if we were dealing with a physical system, we can understand that that would give much more elasticity to the whole system. Everything includes its opposite, and they all link together in different ways. Instead of them being separate units, which the chain is as strong as its weakest link, all these different links interconnect, and so they're able to contain the radiance. The radiance is also on a milder level. We now have the radiance of Tikkun. The whole process is now different. So the radiance is milder, and these spherot are interconnected in all kinds of ways, like the general pattern of the spherot that we have over here, where they all join together, and there's what's called yichudin, unifications. And so therefore, what is the structure that is there is much more stable. It's a stable structure. However, we're now left with the mess, as it were, in existence. Because what's happened is there exist these klipot, these shells, and in the shells are sparks of radiance that really belong up here. Right? So there are sparks of radiance in this finite world, which now has got all kinds of strange, paradoxical qualities. Dangerous paradoxical qualities. Attractions which draw a person from the right path into sin, for example. Beginning with the sin of the tree of knowledge. They had everything. And yet somehow they were drawn into this error of eating from the tree of knowledge. And going on. And then Cain killing Abel. And all the other negative things that are happening. All the way through history to our own time. So there is a process. So this process of having klipa, of having shells with this radiance within them, that helps us understand the ambiguous and dangerous nature of life that we are living, because we are surrounded by different kinds of force, and these are negative forces which can draw us in the wrong direction. How do we carry out this housekeeping job of tidying up? What we have to do is a process called elevation. We have to elevate the spark from the klipa back into the whole system of the sphera. And we, as the Jewish people, we are somehow in the middle, and by us being involved with the world in the right way, we are able to take that spark and transfer it to the place that it's supposed to be. Now, how do we do that? Everything, I'm now looking at Hasidic explanations of what the Kabbalah is presenting. Everything in existence has got this spiritual energy in it. So let's say this table has got this spiritual energy in it. It's got a certain level of spark, of radiance. There are different kinds of klipa. The lower levels of klipa, we cannot engage with directly. So something forbidden by the Torah is because that thing is a lower level of klipa, and it cannot be elevated. So let's say non-kosher food. Non-kosher food has a spiritual energy in it, just as everything does. But the way that we elevate that energy and enable it to rejoin where it's supposed to be is by avoiding the non-kosher food, by holding ourselves back from the non-kosher food. It might be a very difficult situation. We might be very, very tempted. There might be all kinds of reasons around us which would push us towards eating the non-kosher food, and we hold back. And because we're holding back, that's the way in which we're elevating that spark from this lower level of klipa. So the lower klipa is something that we elevate by avoiding, by not doing it. Now the higher level of klipa, yes?
So sorry, is the implication in what you just said that it will only elevate it if the holding back is resisting an urge that otherwise, if it's not, if you're not inclined to succumb to the sin, would it have the same effect of elevation if it is a result of resisting a challenge or a temptation? See what I say?
Well,
it's like looking at the reverse. The good ones, if you elevate it by mitzvot, then can you elevate a negative one? I didn't want to eat it anyway, or I didn't want to do that anyway.
You're raising a very interesting question. You see, there are all kinds of transgressions a person might not be tempted to do in any way. So in what sense is that spark being elevated, you know? So it says in the Talmud, if you sit still and don't transgress, you get the reward as if you fulfilled a mitzvah. So we can sit still and not transgress 613 commandments. You know, we're not, or at least the 365 negative commandments. You know, one by one, I'm not doing this, I'm not doing that. It's wonderful. So some ways of formulating this stress that you have to be in a position where, in some way, there is a choice. You know, there's a choice and a temptation. You're doing something. You're doing something by holding back. It could be that there's another way of elevating it all without having anything to do with it at all. That might be a more spiritual way of elevating it. But the normal way for us is we get into some kind of conflict situation and we remain true to the Torah teaching. Now, there's something I'd like to explain about this Torah teaching. You see, the lower level of klipa, so I'm going to write here, lower klipa. The lower klipa is forbidden. Now, in Hebrew, forbidden is asur. But asur, I think I mentioned this last week, asur also means, what does it mean? In relation to this elevating or not elevating, asur means tied down. Asur is tied down. So the lower klipa is forbidden to eat or whatever it is, and because it's tied down, and it's the same word, the energy is tied down, it cannot be elevated in a direct way. Whereas the higher klipa, which has got it's called noga, higher klipa, right, so I'll just put this term, noga. All this comes from the first chapter of Hezekiah. The higher klipa is called mutar. Mutar means permitted, and what's the other meaning of mutar? Ani rotze lahatir et hakesha hazeh. I want to untie the knot. Mutar means untied. So the radiance for the higher klipa is untied. Now, in other words, the higher level of klipa are the things that are permitted by the Torah. Because there are three levels. There's holiness, unholiness, like the negative of holiness, and then an intermediary level, and that's this noga level. What we do in our lives is we use the noga level of existence in order to affect tikkun, to achieve tikkun, healing, repair, restoration, by elevating the sparks. If this table's noga, so therefore it's untied, it's not stolen, we can use this table for a positive purpose. If we are, as we are this moment, using it to study Torah together, so therefore we are elevating the radiance which is in the table. So the spiritual radiance which is able to be elevated, which is part of Klipat Noga, the Klipa, the higher level Klipa which can rise, is being elevated by the fact that we are using the table for something positive. If God forbid we would use the table for something negative, yes, someone stole a whole lot of loot and he puts it out on the table in order to divide up the loot, the three ganovim are going to divide up what they've stolen, so somehow or other they're using the table for a negative purpose, so they're dragging it down into a lower level. It's the opposite of tikkun.
Can I ask if the the klipot are discarded parts of the radiance, if you like, or splinters from the radiance, why are they necessarily negative?
Well, they're discarded parts of the vessel. Why are they negative? Because the way in which they form in existence is to either conceal godliness or to divert us from the right path in relationship to godliness. In a sense, a false god. It's there's something false. It might have spirituality, but it's false. And it's the fact that there is this high level energy, the radiance of chaos, associated with these false and dangerous aspects of life, helps us understand the paradox of life, that we get attracted into the wrong thing. But
that is an intense paradox, isn't it? Because you're saying that the radiance of Ein Sof is channeled and veiled until it comes into that environment. But then the explosion and the resulting klipot says that the perfection that by definition must be the qualities of that radiance, insofar as it can be described as having qualities at all, is then capable of its nature of generating negativity. So perfection creates negativity without the intervention of us. Because if the sphere explodes and the resulting klipa is negative, the cause of that negativity is the infusion of perfection. Or whether powerful or too much of it, or however one wants to use the words, but the input of perfection generated an exploding, a breaking of the vessel that generates negativity. So in some mysterious, paradoxical way, perfection produces negativity, or the potential for evil, or things that one shouldn't do, or how the right way to describe it. Which is an interesting paradox, just you know.
It's very interesting you put it in those ways. I mean, you know, in a sense, you're putting it in a philosophical way. But I must say that in terms of real life, among other things, I teach in a high school. And one of the problematic aspects of a pupil is the quest for perfection. The pupil who is always like tipexing out anything that she wrote wrong. You know, that's the problem. I try to teach my pupils, listen, the Rambam, when he wrote in his manuscript, you can see he crossed out and he went on the next line. You know, don't worry about crossing things out, because the quest for perfection, in fact, can be dangerous. and it can be very counterproductive, as well as ultimately morally dangerous as well. So, you know, the person always wants something better.
I don't really quite understand how the fire, which is a negative force and which is an attraction to sin, so to speak, it has a spark of radiance in it. Mm. Why doesn't the spark of radiance sort of infect, if you like, or transform the negativity of the Klipa?
Because it's this dangerous radiance. It's the radiance of chaos. You see, the radiance of chaos has a power which is so intense that the way that we appreciate it in this world is as something negative and problematic. Let me try to translate this back into a Torah theme, which in fact is in this week's Seder of the Week. Jacob and Esau. Jacob and Esau, in a sense, looked at through this perspective. Esau is the power of the radiance of chaos, and Jacob is the quality of tikkun. And at the end of Parshat Vayishlach, we have an interesting passage which says, it's going through the generations of Esau. And it says, Ve'ela ha-melachim asher malchu be'eretz Edom. These are the kings who ruled in the land of Edom. So Edom is Esau, and we are going through a whole list of kings. They ruled in Edom, Bela ben Ba'or, and Bela died. And they ruled after him, Yovav, and Yovav died. And they ruled after him, Chusham, and Chusham died. This passage of the death of the kings is understood as a hint to the breaking of the vessels. This is all part of the history of Esau and the nature of Esau. And Esau is the one who comes first. And Esau is this powerful, dangerous force. Now Jacob, in a sense, has to wear the clothes of Esau. He's disguised as Esau. Because us in our world, we're trying to make and establish the world of tikkun, we are clothed in the garments of our animal soul, of our physical appetites, of our physical body, and the physical world around us. We are clothed in klipa. It's the higher level of klipa, hopefully. It's the permitted level. Sometimes you might stray into the forbidden level, God forbid. But as we are, but the divine sacred part is covered in some way with this dangerous quality as well. And we're trying to use that dangerous quality in a positive way. You can eat food which is kosher, and that's wonderful, but a person could be a terrible glutton over kosher food, and they can be so much devoted to the food, they can be selfish and not give another person. There are all kinds of ways of keeping kosher and not doing the right thing with the food. Right? So the higher level of klipa can easily be drawn down into something negative. It can be, it can assume a negative visage, a negative aspect to it. Now, so this process, if we go back to our sheet, this we've now looked at number 5, Tzimtzum, number 6, Shvirat HaKelim, the breaking of the vessels, number 7, the spiritual sparks in physical existence, number 8, the process of Tikkun, and we come to round number 9. Is that all right? I mean, do people feel... Yes.
Can I just make one comment? That, something just resonates is, you know, with the breaking of the vessels. Could it be like a blueprint for the breaking of the first tabernacle? You know, the first...
You mean the destruction of the temple?
No. For the first, you know, the Ten Commandments. The first.
Oh! That's a very interesting comparison.
Because they all flew, didn't they? All spread, flew into the world.
Well, I haven't seen that comparison. It's very interesting and thought-provoking. It's an interesting idea. I mean, there again is one of these interruptions. There we were at Mount Sinai, but the very way, you know, you've got the making of the golden calf. Okay, the whole thing could have been delayed, but it wasn't delayed. He came down with the tablets of stone, and then those were smacked. You know, it's interesting. It's an interesting perspective.
Sorry, can I ask one other
question? Of
course. I understand that the clip-up, really, which are really the hard, the shell-like parts of the vessels. What happened to the light that was in the vessels when they...
Well, part of the light, I think...
Is it that it attached itself to the
clip-up? Yeah, part of the light attached itself to the clip-up. And part of the light was immediately, if you like, gathered up into the world of Tikkun. So there is the idea that there are only Resh Peichet, 288 sparks, which have to be brought back, elevated to their source. And that relates to the word Merachetet. The Spirit of God, this is in the beginning of Bereshit, the Spirit of God, Merachefet, was hovering over the water. Now, that can be translated into the words Resh Peichet, 288. What's the next word? Met. 288 sparks died, so to speak, like the death of the kings at the end of Bayishah. So it's those 288 sparks which we have to elevate. And those are the paradoxes and challenges of our individual lives and the lives of the Jewish people as a whole.
Can you say just a little bit more about hovering over how that connects with that?
Why that term and that verse about the Spirit of God hovering over the water? You see, this whole process took place before the beginning of creation as we read it in the Bible. So the next thing, after this whole thing has happened, we then have God says, let there be light, and so on. But at the very beginning, there is the Spirit of God hovering over the waters. And so what do we learn from the Spirit of God hovering over the waters? That this next step in the process is to elevate these 288 sparks which have fallen and which have to be elevated. So the whole process of creation is like another stage in this longer process of tikkun, right? And that helps us understand why there are such problems in creation. Why Adam and Eve eat from the tree of knowledge? Because the tree of knowledge, physicality itself, carries in it immediately these problematic sparks. The very fact of someone being a physical human being means that there's some problematic energy which we need all the art and humor in order to contain these rival forces which are operating inside us.
Just one further question. At what percentage, this 288, what percentage of the total number is this? Is most of it already in the...
I'm not sure what percent of
them. No, but I mean, is the world most... Do we regard the world as perfect now? And just a little bit imperfect?
I mean... I think so. Yeah. Yes, I think so. And I think it's seen as the, you know, the end of a process.
Right.
This brings us to numbers 9 and 10 on this sheet. The first one is Kavana. Because, now, I think it's quite obvious from the way we've been exploring this, that doing a mitzvah, is going to help this restoration, this process of tikkun. Yes, because doing a mitzvah means we are taking something from the material world. Most mitzvah have something to do with the material world. We're taking, could be money, giving charity. So we're taking something which is physical, which has therefore got this problematic radiance, and we use that for a mitzvah, and as a result the radiance ascends to its proper place in the whole system and tikkun is achieved. And all that is part of a greater process, which is actually the process to bring Mashiach. That's what number 10 is about, the redemption of the Shekhinah, the Divine Presence, and the bringing of Mashiach. But now comes the question, number 9, of Kavanah. Does it help, right, a person, there's a charity box, you put a pound in the charity box. Wonderful. Does it help that when you put the pound in the charity box, you know this pound could have been used for something negative? I could have been very selfish about this pound, but instead I'm going to put it in the charity box, I'm going to give it in tzedakah. As a result, the divine radiance which is there in the pound coin is going to ascend to its proper place in the Sefirot of Tikkun, and in that way that's going to help the coming of Mashiach. Does it help if I am aware of that when I'm carrying out the mitzvah? Now, according to the Kabbalists, yes. There's another approach. A person could say, no, we are not really able to contain such vast ideas. We'll never really understand them properly. Anyway, all we should do is do what the Torah tells us to do and not worry about the mechanism. You know, it's like the doctor says, look, don't worry about the biochemistry, just take this pill, this is what you need, you know. And there's some patients who say, no, I want to see all the research material. They look it up on the web, and they say, but in 1998 there was an experiment that the doctor said, please, you know, just take the pill. So it's, but the Kabbalists say, by all means, come into the laboratory. They want us to be more aware of the whole process, and they believe that by us being more aware of the process with the right kavanah when we're doing the mitzvah, in that way we will facilitate the whole process taking place. So this is a remarkable process which, you see, on one level, the goal of godliness is that the divine presence should dwell in the physical world, that there should be a physical world, and the divine presence should be revealed there. And all these interruptions lead to what is called galut ha-shekhinah, the exile of the Shekhinah. The Shekhinah is not revealed, the Shekhinah is hidden. The sins of Adam and Eve, and of Cain and Abel, and of the generation of the flood, and of the Tower of Babel, and all the other negative things, they are all preventing the revelation of the Shekhinah in the world. And the process of tikkun is to set about achieving the reverse movement, that the Shekhinah should be revealed. And so therefore, the goal of this is the bringing of Mashiach through the fact of our lives living in the world and elevating sparks of holiness through everything that we're doing, whether it is sparks of holiness in permitted things by using those permitted things for mitzvah, or by avoiding doing negative things which are forbidden by the Torah. Now, last week I mentioned, and you know about, the Shabbatian debacle, which was that in the generation after the Arizal, there were people who took this idea to an absurd length by saying, you know what, the difficult thing is, this lower klipa, the realm of the forbidden, the way that you can elevate the sparks in the lower klipa, well, one way is avoidance. But, they might suggest, an even better way is by doing the transgression, God forbid. Doing the transgression and then repenting. So that is, well, it's true that repentance is a way to elevate the radiance from the forbidden lower level. But the idea that you can deliberately sin in order to then elevate that radiance, that is a very dangerous idea, which is not in any of the original Kabbalistic sources, certainly not, and certainly not in the Talmud. The Talmud also speaks about the greatness of repentance, but not in it. It says the place where the repentance stand, ordinary tzaddikim righteous people are not able to stand in that place. But it nowhere suggests that as a result you should do a transgression in order to repent, to be on the ILO. However, unfortunately, the Shabbateans did take this to that conceptual extreme, and they actually did transgressions. And all this began as a hocus-pocus explanation why Shabtai Tzvi converted to Islam when the Sultan told him that if he doesn't convert to Islam, it will be off with his head. Well, I think we can understand perfectly well. You know, he just wanted to save his skin, and so he converted to Islam. There are many great righteous people before him who would not have taken that step. They would have given their lives, especially when, you know, everyone was looking, what is he going to do? But instead, he did make that step, he converted to Islam, and as a result, his followers, led by a man called Nathan of Gaza, cooked up the idea that what he's doing, he's going into the lowest klipa, where it's the real realm of forbidden, the forbidden dimension, in order to elevate everything, and in that way the Mashiach will come. And then Nathan of Gaza began telling other people they should convert to Islam or do other transgressions. And it's a nice News of the World list of transgressions that relates to the history of this movement.
Isn't that sort of perverted approach only conceivably possible in taking a view of separating motives from our intent from actions, and somehow wanting to posit the hypothesis that the action has a physical effect on the fabric of the universe independent of the intent? In other words, if this is a mitzvah, if I fulfill a mitzvah for the worst of motives, for only the reason someone should see me do it, or whatever, base motive, the fact that it's a good deed makes it a good deed independent of my motive in doing it. And this seems to be the other side of that. And that surely is a perversion of the, that if there is, it cannot be a good deed or raising of a lower klipah if it's for the wrong motive.
Yeah, and now when you say this is a perversion, no, what do you mean by this?
What the Shabbateans were saying, that, right, you can do this.
Well, the Shabbateans are saying do a transgression.
Yeah, do a transgression.
But with a positive motive.
No, but this is just mechanistic. So they say, right, you do a transgression in order to repent, because the value of the repentance will exceed, and therefore will outweigh the doing of the transgression, and therefore raise the lower klipah. But this is all done for the motives in doing it is somehow separating the intent from the sin, if you like. So I can commit sins for a good reason, they're not sins, or I can commit mitzvot for bad reasons, or they're still mitzvot.
Well, it's interesting that we come to the modern non-Jewish idea of ends justifying means.
Yeah, that's what Kant was all about,
isn't it?
The kingdom of ends.
Yes, well, and Stalinist communism. You know, you're trying to get to a world of, you know, a blissful world, and so you just have to kill a few hundred thousand factory owners in the process. You know? So that's certainly an aspect of it. I mean, there are all kinds of interesting ramifications. One is their lack of... the Jews in society were generally understood as being very moral. And the idea that Jews could behave in an immoral way with some kind of religious justification for their behavior was regarded by other Jews as absolutely shocking. Someone wrote an article about the response of the Jews in England to Shabbateanism. Shabbateanism was in the late 17th century, and 1666 and onward. And there was great concern about the Anglo-Jewish community at that point, because they were afraid that they would suddenly be seen by the non-Jews in England as immoral people who could do anything because they got some kind of hocus pocus which would permit them to do immoral things. So certainly the Shabbateen position opens up the most terrible things, and in the even worse than Shabtai Tzvi was Jacob Frank in the 18th century, who committed incest and hated the Jews and was trying to get the Talmud burnt and all kinds of negative things. That led to the concealment of the Kabbalah in the 18th century. That's why by the time we get to the 18th century, in Eastern Europe, there is a general feeling the Kabbalistic teaching should only be studied by a small elite and who are true scholars, and everyone else should not delve into these matters because of this terrible explosion of the wrong kind of behavior. And in a way, the very thing that we're talking about, the breaking of the vessels, it's like it's a version of that. It's an expression of religious chaos coming out by teachings which need to be carefully controlled when one is studying those teachings, how one is going to put them into effect.
Does that mean that prior to that period, learning this was fairly mainstream?
It's interesting. You see, in the Talmudic period, it was hidden. The Talmud mentions the idea of study of mystical teachings, but puts it under wraps, and you shouldn't only teach it to people who already understand it, and things like that. You can only teach it to one person at a time, or maybe two people at a time, but not more. Then began a general process of expanding it. Rabbi Isaac Luria said, "Reshut u'mitzvah legalot zot ha-chokhmah." It's permitted, and it's a good deed to reveal these teachings. And then, bang, came another interruption with Shabbateanism in the next century, in the 17th century.
Hasidism, though, came in the 18th century, didn't it?
Yes. Now, Hasidism said, despite all these problems, it's still important to study these spiritual teachings. These spiritual teachings will help vivify and rejuvenate Jewish life and Jewish consciousness, despite all the bans against the Kabbalah. So, in other words, Hasidism came and said, you know what, we need these teachings, even though they can be misused. We'll just have to be very careful not to misuse them. And to present the teachings in such a way that there's a clear emphasis on the way to behave in a positive rather than a negative way. Okay. Now that ends last week's. So I think let's take this week's lecture, which I have now on another piece of paper. Yeah, if that's all right. Now what we're going to do here, B'zrat Hashem, is look at an actual text Now, in terms of diagrams, what would be useful here is just the diagram of the Sfirot that we had last week. Okay. Now, here we have a text from a section of the Zohar. It's from the introduction to Tikkuni Zohar. There are a number of different books in the Zohar group of books. There's Zohar proper, Tikkuni Zohar, Zohar Chadash. This is included in some prayer books, some Ashkenazi prayer books, to be recited as a preparation for Shabbat. In some Sfaradi prayer books, it's an introduction to the morning prayers every day, and in some also to Mincha, the afternoon prayer. So in other words, it's seen as a preparatory prayer. It's a preparatory text preparing us for prayer. And the Sfaradi custom, where it's both for Shachrit and for Mincha, is taking that in a very intense form. There is a fairly common Hasidic practice, Ashkenazi Hasidic practice, where it's part of the introduction to Shabbat. Now, so the question is now about the whole place of the Zohar, this very, very spiritual book, which, although it is so spiritual, for the most part, is not directly learnt. It's learnt a bit. There's certain situations where Zohar is studied. For example, in the Tikkun Leil Shavuot, staying up all night before Shavuot, there's a whole section from the Zohar. There's a long tikkun, which itself is of Kabbalistic origin. It's become very popular today. Many places that one just simply studies Talmud or has talks, lectures, and coffee and cake. But the Kabbalistic way of fulfilling the Tikkun Leil Shavuot is to say the beginning and end of every parsha in the Torah, with a little bit more emphasis on some parshiot, for example, reciting the whole of the everything about the Ten Commandments and so on. Then the beginning of and end of every book in Tanakh, so the beginning and end of Joshua and of Judges and of Samuel, and of course when it comes to the book of Ruth, reading the whole book of Ruth, because that relates to Shavuot, and so on through the whole Tanakh. Then the beginning and end of every tractate in the Mishnah. So it's like a bird's eye view of the whole Torah. And then there's a section of Zohar. So there's a long section of Zohar all about, a relatively long section, all about this process of staying up all night before Shavuot and the special spiritual atmosphere before Shavuot. Another time when it's fairly common, very common, I would say, in the traditional community, to say this tikkun and the bits of Zohar that go with it. At the end of that whole tikkun is a quote from the Zohar. Rabbi Shimon says, Anan fa'as b'chavivuta talya milta. The thing depends on love. And that's the end of the whole tikkun leil shavuot. Some people also say the listed the 613 mitzvot as well before that. So it's like the night before the giving of the Torah on Shavuot, it's as if one has gone, had a bird's eye view of the whole Torah, including elements of the Kabbalah, and Sefer Yetzirah, the book of creation, and ending in this way, for us it all depends on that. Now, that's a very, very common practice. Another very common practice in the traditional community is the night before a Brit. Before Brit Milah, the father of the child is supposed to stay up and recite a similar tikkun. Now, there are different opinions what is in the tikkun, but the main part of the tikkun is about 10-12 pages of Zohar about Brit Milah. And so saying that Zohar from Lech Lecha, where Avraham Avinu gets the mitzvah of Brit Milah. So in the Zohar, on Lech Lecha, there's a whole section about Brit Milah. So one says that as a preparation to the Brit, and it doesn't have to be just the father by himself. A few friends of his or relatives can come along as well, and they share out the Zohar. You know, so if you have a few people, so each one takes two pages, and you get through it quicker. But it means that there is a fairly general relationship with those Zoharic teachings. Now, there are other bits of Zohar in the prayer book. There is Brich Shmei de Male Alma, when the ark opens, there is a passage of the Zohar there, and which is in most Siddurim. And then in the Hasidic Siddur, there is a section called Gavna, just before Baruch Hu on Friday night, which describes the spiritual realms and the physical realms somehow getting in sync together just before Shabbat, the same way as it is above, so it is below, a very beautiful passage. And here, this passage is also a beautiful introduction to Shabbat. Now, we have the idea of sermons by Elijah in the Garden of Eden. Now, that's a fascinating thing because this begins, Patach Eliyahu, Elijah began. Elijah began speaking. Now, the Zohar, to a considerable extent, is understood as revelation of Elijah the prophet to Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai, writing it down. To a certain extent, and some points more clearly that, as in this case, where it's very obviously it mentions Elijah and his whole teaching. There is a midrash, quite a popular midrash nowadays, called Tana Bebe Eliyahu, a midrash which is mentioned or seems to be mentioned in the Talmud, and is understood as being the teachings of Elijah, and these teachings of Elijah are quite popular midrash. You will find in many people's homes, and general bookshops. It's always being reprinted in one form or another. That's another example, a sort of more accessible example of Elijah teaching. We then have the actual text. Number 3 speaks about different places where one can look up more and commentaries on the text. But now we're going to, since we've only got a few minutes, we're going to enter into the text now. Are you happy with Ashkenazi or Sephardi pronunciation?
I
shall
Sephardi.
You prefer. Okay. Patach Eliyahu v'amah. Elijah began and he said, Ribon Almin, Master of the Worlds. Now immediately we have worlds in the plural. That's very interesting. You see the word Ribono Shel Olam, Master of the World, is a very common statement by the sages. But here we have Master of the Worlds. The Antu Chad, you are one, below b'chushva, but beyond number. You're not one because there's one and then there's two and three and four. You are one, it means there's only you. You are beyond. It's absolutely you, this total oneness. Antu ilah al kol ilai. You are exalted above all exalted things. Stima, you are hidden. Al kol stimin, above all hidden things. So there are many levels which are hidden, but you are beyond all of them. Leit machshavat fisabach klau, thought does not grasp you at all. There's another passage which says, thought doesn't grasp you at all, but you can be grasped by the yearning of the heart. So the yearning of the heart is able to reach godliness, even though rational thought cannot. And now, in a sense, what we're speaking to is the infinite Ein Sof. We're speaking to Ein Sof beyond all these worlds and Sfirah and Tzimtzum, all that. We're just speaking to the very essence. Unto the Apikas Asatikumin, you brought out, you created, you formed 10 what we call Sfirah. The Karim and the Hon Asas Sfirah, you call them the 10 Sfirah. It's interesting, they're called originally Tikkunim. But you call them the 10 Sfirah. Lan Haga the Hon Almin, to guide and run the worlds. Because one Sfirah is kindness and another is severity and so on. So it relates to the way in which God is running the world. There are some worlds which are hidden and not revealed. And there are other worlds which are revealed. And in these sfirot, and worlds perhaps as well, you are hidden from human beings. You are hidden from human beings because human beings cannot see Ein Sof at all, but what they can see is the effect of the kindness of God or the severity of God. Va'antu de kashelon, you are the one who binds them together, these sfirot, u'meyachidlon, and you make unifications with them. U'begin de ant bulgav, and since you are within these sfirot, your radiance, your infinite radiance is there within the sfirot. You see in this diagram, it's the divine radiance which is flowing through. Kol man, anyone who separates one from the other of these ten sfirot, in other words, causes some kind of disunity among the sfirot, it's considered for that person as if he's caused some kind of disunity, God forbid, in God. Now this is a very, very interesting concept, which I've written over here in number 5, the effect of sin disturbing the spiritual realms. You see, by us transgressing in some way, this is another way of understanding what happens when we transgress. Incidentally, in terms of this diagram, our transgressions, God forbid, cause a kind of energy to flow to the klipot, strengthening the klipot. So we are in the middle of this structure. We can either elevate everything and bring it closer to God, to its real completion, or we are allowing a kind of a leakage of holiness flowing down into lower levels, causing more problems. So we are in a very crucial situation in terms of the whole balance of existence. Now here it's giving the same sense of responsibility to the individual. And this, I think, is a central characteristic of the Kabbalah. Taking it beyond the general narrative of the Talmud, although you can see glimpses of this in the Talmud. The basic approach of the Talmud is this, is if a person does good, they are rewarded by God, and if, God forbid, they do bad, then they're punished. Is the punishment in this world or in the world to come? Whichever, but that's the general equation, that's the general narrative. And the Talmud is explaining exactly what is the divine will, how do we fulfill our duty in relation to God. The Kabbalists say right from the certainly this Zoharic stage, our actions affect the whole of existence. It is our actions which are going to change the nature of the spiritual background to the universe. So if we transgress, we are causing disunity in the system of the Sfirah. The normal way of understanding the disunity is the Sfirah Malchut is separated from the other Sfirah. So we cause this disunity if we transgress, and through positive action and repentance and good deeds, we rejoin. We are able to join the sphere up. So therefore, the nature of the worlds really depends on us. Now, there are little glimpses of this in Talmudic literature, and it's interesting that Maimonides puts it very clearly. And the whole question of, is the Rambam a rationalist or not? This is a crucial passage. In Laws of Tshuva, Laws of Repentance, I think it's chapter 3, he says, a person should always consider himself as equally balanced between good and bad, and the whole world as equally balanced between good and bad, and if you do one good deed, you will tip the whole world to good, or the opposite, God forbid. So in other words, the balance of the world depends on the individual. And that's really, in general, that is a mystical perspective rather than the straight Talmudic perspective, even though there are glimpses of that in the Talmud, including what the Rambam is saying there. But in the Talmud, it's like one line absorbed among everything else, whereas the Rambam presents it in a very emphatic way. Now we've actually reached the end of our time. because we try to put the infinite into the finite, and we have to accept the limitations of time. By all means, read this text, and it will help understand this concept of the Sfirot, the way in which the Sfirot are seen in kind of anthropomorphic terms, that's referred to over here. But above all, you see the extolling of the greatness and the oneness and the unity of God in a most incredible, exultant way, and one is really able to see why this should be a preparation for prayer.
Can one extend the concept to an almost nuclear fusion by saying that if the purpose of creation is to create such a physical mass of mitzvot, if you can achieve a sufficient critical mass of mitzvot, you actually cause the Mashiach to come in a, as I said, in a metaphor almost like a nuclear reactor, that you will force it back up the system to the point where creation has no choice in it.
I think that's a reasonable way of looking at it. You know, it's some kind of tipping of the balance.
Yeah.
It's the Talmud does speak about, you know, the Mashiach will come to a generation which is completely meritorious, or one which is completely the opposite. But the general way of looking at things is that every positive act will have a positive effect, and there's a certain sense of tipping the balance. And there's the question. Let's hope we do that.